The death of which U.S. president elicited no response from the U.S. government? What's the correct answer to this question? Who is buried in Grant's tomb? Well, the answers may not be what you think. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. We'll get the answers to those and many other questions that shed light on the relationship between Americans and their chief executives. And the answers are going to be coming from Brady Carlson, WPR's All Things Considered host, and also the author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders, published by W.W. Norton in 2016. Welcome to WPR and welcome to University of the Air.
It's so great to be with you, Norman. Thanks so much.
Now, one of the reviewers of your book has called it a kind of light-hearted look at this otherwise grim topic. What is to be learned from such a light-hearted look at dead presidents?
I think it's a fun way to get at some weighty issues that, I mean, if you just present someone with, here's the decline and fall of every president in a very somber historical way, I don't know if you're going to reach people in quite the same way. But what I find is that you get to go to the memorials, the monuments, the presidential library, sometimes these very odd, kitschy statues and historic sites that we have hung on to all these years. And you get to appreciate that the post-presidency, as I call it, the presidential afterlife, is a reflection of how we, the people, view the institution of the presidency, how we view the people who take on that job, and really how we view ourselves, because the president is the only position that all of us play a part in choosing. So the way that we look on the presidency gives us a nice window into who we are and how we view ourselves.
And I'm gathering that that view over the course of the last 200 and some years has changed.
Tremendously. I mean, you think of the way that the founders originally envisioned the presidency. It was very different from the job that Barack Obama now holds and that the candidates are now vying for in the 2016 election. George Washington, of course, was everyone's first choice for the first president. And the idea was you would have a private citizen take on a very public job, exercise great power responsibly for a set period of time, and then voluntarily relinquish that power, give it to someone else and have them do it. You wouldn't have someone ruling for a generation or passing on power to an heir. It would be a person chosen in some form by the people. And the presidential afterlife was initially viewed that same way too. George Washington, who obviously had an eye toward history and cared about his public reputation after he was gone, wanted essentially to be left alone when he wrote his will. He asked that there be no funeral speeches, no long parades, no processions in his honor after he died, and he didn't get any of what he asked for. He got a very, very large spectacle, really more than funeral, at his plantation, Mount Vernon in Virginia. There were four speakers instead of the zero that he had asked for, and there were long parades. They had the riderless horse. There were cannons fired over the Potomac River, and that really set the standard for a president's funeral with George Washington and everything else that came with George Washington along with it. So the idea of a president who would then go retreat back into private life and disappear from the scene completely never really quite happened.
It suggests that once you're president, you belong to the people not only for life but afterward too.
For afterlife. A president's job is really never done, and that's why I call it the post-presidency, because they do have lots of work to do. We keep them very, very busy. The most obvious example of that is that they serve as namesakes. I mean, the capital of our own state is an example of that. But we put their names on buildings and schools, rivers, sometimes even in space. There are, I think, about a half a dozen asteroids that are named for presidents. And sometimes we put them even on products. I remember when I was traveling for the book doing my research that I started to see presidential Pez dispensers for all of those people out there.
You mean who, all 40-some of
them? Yeah, they were putting them out five at a time. And anybody who wanted to take Martin Van Buren's head and sort of snap it back to get a candy out of his neck, they now have that opportunity.
Did that include living former presidents?
They haven't gotten to them yet, uh-huh. But I imagine in time they will get to that.
Oh, I know there is a law that says you can't put a living person on U.S. Currency or coins, but of course that followed very immediately the death of JFK in 1963. He was on the half dollar within the year. It took an act of Congress, I think, to pull that off, though. But getting back to Washington, wasn't there some intent of having him entombed in the Capitol building?
There was talk at one point, and Congress made a very, very almost successful pitch to Martha Washington, his widow, saying we would, as they were building the Capitol and the Capitol city as a whole, we would like to have the general's final resting place be somewhere where the people can revere and honor him at all times. At that time, Mount Vernon was still in private hands. It was not accessible to the public, at least officially. Unofficially, people came there all the time and invited themselves to see the Washingtons, not only living but also dead. And Martha Washington's answer was quite telling. She said to the effect that, I don't want this. I know it's the exact opposite of what my husband wanted, but the Washingtons do what the public demands of them, and so I guess I'm going to have to. Eventually, common sense did prevail, and the rest of the family wound up telling Congress to buzz off, more or less, that General Washington's will had said he wants to stay at Mount Vernon, and that is where he's going to stay. But by that point, they had already built the room under the Capitol Rotunda in which the sarcophagus was supposed to stay. And so now that's been put to a different use. When you come to the Capitol for a tour, the tour guides will take you from the Capitol Visitor Center into a round room with big pillars and ornate designs called the Crypt. And that's where that room came from.
Just a crypt, though.
It's just a crypt.
Nothing else going on there.
And people just talk about it matter-of-factly. You know, it's just, oh, this is just the crypt. Welcome.
Now, the first president to die in office, I suppose, would have had a special public response. In this case, it was William Henry Harrison, 1841, after a whopping month in office.
It was quite a tenure.
One of those presidents who was had been a general, and that is considered often a fast track to the presidency. You become popular as a general and you become the president. In his case, not for long. One story that you hear is he caught cold at the inauguration. The speeches were so long and the day so cold. This was back on March 4th of 1841 that
Washington, D.C. is known for its warm weather, but when it's cold, it's cold. And in March of 1841, it was quite cold. William Henry Harrison was, in addition to being a military man, used to living out in the field, had also been something of a farmer and didn't think much of having to put on a coat and formal wear. That was not really his style. Though it should be noted that he had also served in a number of other governmental capacities. He had been a senator and he had served as a territorial governor. So he had political experience as well as his military experience. The problem he had was that he was viewed by most of the sort of political watchers of his day as a policy lightweight. He wasn't really smart enough to be president. At least that's what the people in the other party were saying at the time, that he didn't seem to understand the power and the responsibility of his new job, and he wanted to prove those critics wrong. So he decided to write a very, very long speech, as we often do when, say, we have to do a book report and we don't really understand the book that well. We figure the more we talk about it, maybe we'll finally explain what it is we're talking about and people will think we've really done a great job. So he wrote what is still to this day the longest inaugural address of all time.
Shortest presidency, longest speech.
Longest inaugural address. The problem was he was doing this out in the cold and snow with no hat and no coat, and he did catch cold. It's now not for sure that that's what actually did him in. The alternate theory is that the water and sewer system was so bad in Washington, D.C. in the 1840s that may have actually weakened his immune system and killed them. But he did have at least one cold, possibly two, and possibly pneumonia during those 30 days of the presidency. The long and the short of it is that he did pass away exactly a month after he gave that speech in the cold and the snow. And that, not his military record, not his political experience, not his role in shaping the country in the first half of the 19th century. What we remember about William Henry Harrison was that he died in office faster than any president in American history. And we look back on him in a way that parents often look at their kids when they're not putting their snow pants on to go out and play in the winter.
Remember,
you kids, remember what happens when you don't put on your coat in the snow. We sort of judge him in that way. And so often what we find in the afterlives of the presidents is that the timing of their deaths matters. It can make a president's reputation much stronger, or it can actually ruin a reputation, as it did for William Henry Harrison.
And so William Henry Harrison was succeeded by a president that we've already referred to earlier in the hour. One of our opening quiz questions had to do with the Tyler who succeeded Tippecanoe. And he was a Virginian and did fill out a term of office.
He did, and managed to make more than a few enemies in the process. Tyler was not a go-along, get-along kind of president. He had never been that way when he served as a member of Congress and was just a guy who preferred to, we'll put it charitably, he felt very strongly about his core principles and didn't feel the need to compromise, which is often the case with politicians. And in the process, he managed to not only offend the opposition party, but his own party, to the point that while he was the sitting president of the United States, his own party kicked him out of the party. So he was a president without a party and not a terribly well-liked fellow. In fact, there was such concern at the time about the enemies that he was making that they decided to hire the first security guards at the White House.
No kidding.
They were called doormen. They didn't want people thinking that the president was hiring his own security men. They didn't want anyone to think that he is assembling, say, a private army or something like that. But Tyler managed to stick with his principles even for decades after his presidency. So when the Civil War came along, he's a Virginian. He decides, after trying in vain to reach some kind of peace deal between the North and the South, decides to side with the Confederacy and his home state of Virginia. He is elected to serve in the new Confederate Congress and has just come to Richmond, Virginia in late 1861, early 1862 to take his seat, and he has a stroke and dies. So at the time of his death, and like William Henry Harrison, timing matters. Technically, John Tyler is engaged in open rebellion against the government that he once led. He's a traitor to his own country, at least in the eyes of the law. And so normally when a president passes away, the sitting president issues a very formal sort of boilerplate declaration. It is my sad duty to report that my predecessor, insert name here, has died. And then goes on to extol all of the great virtues of his public service and his presidency. Abraham Lincoln, who is president at the time of John Tyler's death, issues no public statement. In fact, the federal government issues no public acknowledgement of John Tyler's death at all. They just said, you're dead to us. And the Confederates at the time decided, well, he's going to be our president then. So they throw him their state funeral. So they have him laying in state at the Confederate Capitol in Richmond. They have a big parade and they have him entombed at his now hilltop gravesite in Richmond, Virginia's Hollywood Cemetery. John Tyler had hoped to be buried at home, which is about an hour south of Richmond. It's a plantation called Sherwood Forest. But that was occupied by Union troops at the time. There was no way that they could get his body back for burial. So they put him in what they felt was the next best spot, which was on that hilltop in Richmond, right near another former president buried there, James Monroe. So they now have a place at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond called President's Circle.
With the two of them.
With the two of them up there.
And many distinguished Confederate generals to boot.
Yes, plenty.
Yes, it's quite the landmark, Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. So, other than Richmond, are there memorials to John Tyler to this day?
Not many. I did manage to go to Sherwood Forest when I was there. The best memorials that we have to John Tyler, other than his formal grave marker, are living ones. John Tyler, who was president in the 1840s, has two living grandsons in the year 2016.
Isn't that remarkable?
Tyler had 15 children. That's a record for presidents. And his last child was fathered when he was 70, I think. So he had children late in life. His children had children late in life as well. And the Tylers tend to live long. His two living grandsons are advanced in age, but are still active and still appear in public from time to time and are happy to chat about their grandfather, who was president before the Civil War.
That's amazing. It is one of those amazing 2 degrees of separation stories. There was some years ago, I'm going to say, gosh, it must have been close to 40 years ago, some little afterlife controversy regarding the demise of Zachary Taylor, who was another one of those presidents who didn't last very long after a long military career, a very short presidential one. But there were even some, hard to believe, but some conspiracy theorists that said, well, his successor, Millard Fillmore, had somehow maneuvered his death, had arranged to have him poisoned. And so there was this movement to actually exhume the late president, Taylor, and prove or disprove this theory.
Yeah, 140 years after he died. So Zachary Taylor was elected president in 1848. He dies in 1850. He had been at a fundraiser for the Washington Monument on a very hot 4th of July. Imagine that, a hot 4th of July in Washington, D.C. Zachary Taylor did what doctors in Washington at the time had asked people not to do, which was to eat cold cherries and drink iced milk. Those were believed to be suspect. They were spreading some of the diseases that had been moving around the city, and there were plenty of those at the time. And Taylor, unsurprisingly, got sick very quickly after that hot day and this meal that doctors had warned him not to have. And a few days later, he died. Now, they didn't do an autopsy. His wife didn't want him embalmed and just had him shipped back to Kentucky for burial, Louisville. And so they never for sure pinpointed what caused his death. They just used a catch-all term, which was cholera morbus. It was essentially some kind of intestinal issue caused President Zachary Taylor's death. But I should also say that any time a president has died before his term was up, there have been people convinced that this was not due to any kind of illness or natural cause, that it was due to a conspiracy, that that person had to have been murdered. And that was certainly the case in Zachary Taylor's day. Zachary Taylor dying in 1850 at the height of the debate over the Compromise of 1850,
sure,
where the North and South were arguing very, very strongly about laws that people thought maybe this would keep the Union together for a little while longer, and other people saying that if this happens to go through, that it will actually speed up the demise of the Union. Zachary Taylor, so the conspiracy theorist said, was arguing a position that would have saved the Union, and his successor, Millard Fillmore, who might have had him murdered or other people murdered him to get Fillmore in power, represented the slave owners, and that Taylor was fighting for the anti-slavery forces. If anything, it probably would have been the other way around, because Millard Fillmore was from New York State and was against slavery. Zachary Taylor was a Kentuckian who owned slaves. Nonetheless, that was the working theory of the conspiracy theorists. What led to his exhumation in the 1990s was a writer and a professor named Clara Rising, who had been in Louisville for a book event and had spent some time with some of Taylor's descendants and just became very, very fascinated by this theory that he had been murdered, that it wasn't an intestinal problem. And so she did some background reading and came to the conclusion that he definitely was murdered.
Poisoned.
And it had definitely been poisoned, and it had definitely been covered up. And so she started lobbying the family. She started lobbying the coroner in Louisville. She started lobbying basically everyone she could to say, we need to look at this again.
Catch was, well, who had jurisdiction over the cemetery?
The military had jurisdiction over the cemetery, which is called Zachary Taylor National Cemetery, but over the land on which Zachary Taylor is entombed, Taylor's descendants had jurisdiction. So it was up to them to decide what would go on. So she got the county coroner to agree to look at his remains. She got the family to agree to have them removed from his crypt. And they tried as best they could to do this in a discreet way. But, of course, the news media got hold of it. And so you
have... Was this a nocturnal exhumation?
they did it during the day, but they had a big tent over the crypt. And they had cameras and reporters and all sorts of gawkers sort of keeping an eye on things as they hauled this casket back to a lab for some testing. They took some fingernail samples, some hair samples, and, you know, you'd basically been skeletonized what they found. And once the test results came back in, they found that despite her, Clara Rising's insistence that he had probably been poisoned by arsenic, that there was no more arsenic in his system than anybody else would have had.
It was pretty common out there. The same thing happened with Napoleon, if I remember correctly, that, oh, they found arsenic in his hair and his nails, but
and
they
it's
could have
out
dug
there.
Up any
so
number of other people found the same thing.
I mean, you'll find it if you test someone's fingernails. They said his levels were no higher than anyone else's. Even despite that, though, people still from time to time say, but wasn't he poisoned? And Clara Rising was never fully convinced
really,
that even despite the testing. And you know, I think there's something very American about that. We're
taught to doubt.
We are taught to doubt, and we're not always convinced that the official record is the story. And we've seen that certainly not just with Zachary Taylor's death, but you think of the Kennedy assassination when, you know, you could have 1,000 ballistic experts and you could have had a video recorder pointed right at that nest up at the 6th floor of the book depository in Dallas. And that would still have people saying, well, I'm not so sure. And so that's just how we are when it comes to something that we invest so much of ourselves in, like the presidency.
We're going to look further at the presidency, in particular the way we have revered or treated our deceased presidents, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Brady Carlson. He's our WPR All Things Considered host, but he's also the author of a book called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And from looking at some of these stories, strange, sometimes to even amusing stories, I think you could say we learn a lot about how we look at our presidents over the course of time. One that we've mentioned already and probably has received more press than any regarding, you might say, his posthumous career was Abraham Lincoln.
Most definitely. And of course, we've talked about how timing matters in a president's reputation, and Abraham Lincoln's story is built on not just his accomplishments, but also the end of his story, his death and his afterlife, the tragic murder, the first president to be assassinated, and the human drama of chasing the assassin through Washington, D.C. and through the East Coast, and then the travels Washington or Lincoln's body makes as it leaves Washington and comes back home for burial in Springfield, Illinois. When Lincoln first came to Washington to be president, he took a train and he made a very it was a very long train trip to Washington. He could have taken a fast train there, but he wanted to stop and explain himself. Ahead of the Civil War, he wanted to try and bring people back on board to the country and dispel any concerns that people might have about what kind of leader he would be like, whether he would try to outlaw slavery in the southern states or anything like that. And so he made a number of public appearances along the way. And after he died, the family had decided they wanted him to come back to Springfield. But how he was going to get there was still a question. The military had offered up trains, but then the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who was a close friend of Lincoln's by the end of the war, said, "What if we send Lincoln back home in a reverse train tour of what he had done when he first came here?" The people got to say hello to him and meet him as he came to take the oath of office and come to the White House. Why don't we have them get a chance to say goodbye?
Just 4 years later.
And so they sent him back. It wasn't precisely the same route that he had taken to get to Washington, but it was close. He stopped in all of the big cities of the day, and millions of people came out to see Lincoln's body. It was also one of the first high-profile cases of embalming. Embalming had been used during the Civil War, but this was the first time where you could send the remains of an American president out on the road for 2 weeks and have public receptions, and he would still look something like himself. It wasn't a perfect art at that point, and there were many stories about how the closer they got to Springfield on this two-week trip, that they would have to put very fragrant flowers around the body.
And chalk the face.
Lots of chalk along the face. They would redo the makeup constantly. They had two embalmers travel on the funeral train along with the rest of the entourage and members of the family. But people clearly did want to say goodbye, and it got to the point where cities would almost engage in a kind of contest to who could mourn Abraham Lincoln the most. So one city would put up, you know, hundreds and hundreds of black wreaths and big signs, and then the next city would try and put up bigger signs and more flowers. And then, of course, Springfield, his hometown, which is not a large city compared to New York or Philadelphia, had to try and outdo all of them.
It says something about Americans, doesn't it?
It certainly does. We even take our mourning as a kind of competition.
Yeah.
And the other piece of this was that Edwin Stanton had something of an ulterior motive. He, like many people, were trying to figure out what to do now that the war was over with the southern states, with the armies that had fought against the Union troops for 4 years, and how that political reconciliation was going to take place. Lincoln had himself offered some kind of a reconciliation that was rather light. He said something that his policy could be described as let them up easy. And others like Stanton said, this is a group of people who caused hundreds of thousands of people to be killed and devastation across the country, great tragedy.
Waving the bloody shirt.
They called it waving the bloody shirt. They said, we cannot forget how many people spilled their blood because these people wanted to leave the country. And so they wanted the South to be punished. By putting Lincoln's body on display, he essentially wanted to rile people up so that they would want more punitive measures toward the southern states as they tried to rejoin the Union.
Killed by a southerner.
John Wilkes Booth was a southerner who believed in white supremacy and believed in slavery and did not believe in African Americans having the right to vote or go to school or any of those things, and pointedly said those things as the reasons why he killed Abraham Lincoln. So they wanted to make it perfectly clear. This is the attitude and this is the mindset that killed your president. This right here in front of you is the visceral reminder of what the South has brought you. And they wanted that on the record. And in some cases, it worked very well because there were people who were very riled up and treated the South harshly during the Reconstruction period.
No, there was a temporary crypt in Springfield, right?
There was. Mm-hmm.
Was there a kidnapping attempt?
there was a grave robbery attempt on Abraham Lincoln's tomb in Springfield in 1876. The going description of the people involved in this plot it comes down to the word knuckleheads, which should tell you essentially how well this went. If you're going to try and break into the tomb of the most revered man in American history, you probably don't want to brag about it at every bar in town before you do so. What happened was they had been looking for a way to spring one of their friends out of jail. This was a counterfeiting ring, which was big money in those days. And they figured the best way to do that Why they thought this was the best way, I still don't know. But they thought the best way would be to hold Lincoln's body for ransom, hide it somewhere in the Indiana dunes until the state of Illinois coughed up enough money and pardoned their friend. They were so vocal about trying to recruit people to be part of this grave robbery scheme that they managed to alert the U.S. Secret Service, which was in charge of fighting counterfeiting at the time, and had essentially an informant join their gang. So they knew everything these people were doing. The authorities were not that well trained to deal with this kind of situation. They were pretty bumbling and inept themselves. And so the men did break in and get away from the scene of the crime. They caught up with them a few days later when they came back to the same bar they had been bragging about this idea in the first place. The net effect of this was that the people in charge of Abraham Lincoln's tomb felt that it was no longer safe to keep him in a public place.
He hadn't actually been absconded with, though.
No, the sarcophagus was too heavy, and they couldn't get it open, and they couldn't get it out the door. But still, the people in charge of the tomb said, this is too much of a risk. Somebody more competent will come along one day and try to steal his body. And so they formed this something of a secret society to guard over Abraham Lincoln's remains and the remains of his family. And for a while, what that meant was leaving the public crypt in place as if there was something in there, but hiding the body in the basement of the tomb. They just dug a big hole and put the caskets in there and didn't tell anybody. So they would have construction crews come in to fix some of the structural issues with the tomb because it was prone to flooding, as these things often are. And they would not know that as they were working, they would be stepping on ground where Abraham Lincoln was buried. And they moved the casket a few more times until the turn of the century in about 1901, when Abraham Lincoln's son Robert came up with the idea of burying his parents' remains in concrete. They poured concrete over it and then had that structure placed about 12 feet underneath the ground. So if you visit the tomb today in Springfield, you will see a sarcophagus, but it's actually empty. So it's not really a sarcophagus. The Lincolns are actually still 12 feet under the ground encased in concrete. So no one is going to come by and steal those bodies again, at least not without an enormous amount of effort.
Determination.
Yeah.
Who really is buried in Grant's tomb?
Ah, it's a trick question. No one is buried in Grant's tomb because in tomb, you don't bury people. They are above ground. General Grant and his wife are entombed in Grant's tomb. So their remains are in sarcophagi above the ground. Grant's tomb is the largest of any presidential tomb. It's an enormous place in northern Manhattan, not far from Harlem.
Riverside Drive?
Riverside, mm-hmm, yep.
Overlooking the river. Why there? No, I mean, he did spend time in New York, but like Lincoln, was from Illinois. Spent a lot of time in Washington, I guess, even after his presidency. But why New York?
He had been living in New York after settling down. He had done some touring in his post-presidency. He had traveled through Europe and done some other work like that. And he settled down in New York City. When he realized he was dying, Grant had come down with cancer and had been told he had about a year to live, and decided that he wanted to be buried in a place that would also let him be buried or entombed next to his wife. And some of the places in Washington, D.C., for example, or West Point was a place that was considered at one point. But none of those places would let his wife, Julia, be buried or entombed right next to him. And that was the one condition he had set. So the Parks Department in New York City said, well, we'll be happy to provide a space for both of you. You can have your choice of any of our parks. And Central Park was an obvious location because it's Central Park. And that was near where
they
lived. And it's big. And they thought that the Morningside Heights neighborhood and Riverside would be a little bit calmer, a little more peaceful. They knew that plenty of people would come to see Grant's tomb over the years. And that has certainly been the case. But they thought that would be a little bit far outside of the action.
It would have, yes. What, in 1883?
Mm-hmm. Just about then. And Grant's funeral parade was something like 5 miles long. and Manhattan is 13 miles long. So you have almost the half the length of the island of Manhattan covered in people, including, I think, three current or former presidents paying their respects to Ulysses S. Grant. I mean, that's what the hero of the Civil War meant to people in the 1880s.
You have another martyred president all too soon after Lincoln's assassination, just a scant 16 years later.
Yeah, James A. Garfield, who was – it was an interesting situation for the country. Lincoln was a well-known figure and a very larger-than-life figure. Even – he wasn't always beloved as president, but he was certainly an enormous figure living through an enormous period of the country's history. James A. Garfield was well-liked, but he had only been in office a few months when he was shot and then lived a few more months after that before dying. And the public really hadn't gotten to know him. He was not a well-known national figure when he was unexpectedly chosen as the nominee in the 1880 election. So he was still something of a blank for most Americans. And yet, here's your president who's just been shot and is laying on his deathbed. We got to all pull together. And so they sort of did what they felt people should do when a president was injured or mortally wounded. And they essentially – he was shot just a few days before 4th of July. So for the first time in the country's history, there were no Independence Day celebrations. Nobody was shooting off fireworks because the president had just been shot. And so it was a very somber period. And they talk about people would be waiting desperately for updates from the president's doctors being sent through to New York City or to Chicago by telegraph. And people would stand outside of the White House and try to find out what had happened to the president's condition. President Garfield had been shot at a train station in Washington, D.C. by a deranged office seeker who was almost certainly out of his mind with mental illness of some kind. And he had not been injured so badly that he couldn't have recovered were it not for incompetent medical care. The doctors of the day did not believe in germs. And so consequently, they didn't believe in things like washing their hands. So the doctors, once he had been shot in the back, were poking their fingers, which they had not washed or cleaned or sterilized, into his wound over and over. And that created essentially a chain reaction of infections that is what actually killed the president. It was a very, very agonizingly painful way to go. James A. Garfield had been a very athletic man. He was only 49 when he took office and lost, I want to say, something like 80 pounds in the time between when he was shot and when he died. He had been a very vigorous man and just shrunk into a frail man who could do very little more than lay down and listen to people. The doctors told him that it was bad for him to talk, so they didn't let him have very many visitors. So he had to sit by himself, and he was a very sociable kind of fellow. So he was in agony in a number of different ways. One friend came to visit him and got past the doctor somehow, and he wrote in Latin, "Strangulatus por Republica." Tortured for the Republic was the way that he felt his life had gone.
He was classically trained. Garfield knew his Latin, I think Greek, and could write with both hands at the same time.
At the same time, he was an exceptionally smart and capable person. The best book to read about James A. Garfield is a book called Destiny of the Republic by Candace Millard, which I read three or four times when I was learning about James A. Garfield. And she makes a great case that there are few people who have stood as president of the United States who were as smart and talented as James A. Garfield. Who knows what kind of life and what kind of presidency he could have had if it hadn't been for the doctors and the bullet holes.
Might have been better than his successor, Chester A. Arthur, whose name does not exactly merit a lot of memorials around the country.
Chester A. Arthur does not have a lot of memorials around the country, although I'll say that a lot of that is his own doing. We certainly think, and rightly so, that most presidents want to be remembered and to be remembered well. And so they put a lot of effort into writing memoirs and giving speeches and playing up the accomplishments that they had while they were in office. Chester A. Arthur is one of the few exceptions. A few days before he died, he turned to his relatives and asked them to burn all of his public papers. It hearkened back to something he had said once when a visitor at the White House had asked about something he had done. And he said, "Madam, I may be president of the United States, but my personal life is none of your damned business." He didn't want people to know. He hadn't sought the office. He only became president because Garfield had died. And say he essentially wanted to be left alone, not only as president, but in the afterlife as well.
And that explains, I think, in good measure, why there was no second term for Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah, you have to want to put yourself out there if you're going to try and get yourself another term in office.
Not exactly a backslapper.
Not entirely, no.
Well, we're going to look at a few more presidents and a 20th century phenomenon in the presidential afterlife, and we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Brady Carlson, and we're looking at what might be called presidential afterlives, the reputations and the memorials to presidents over the years, which tell us a good deal about Americans and the way we view our chief executives over the course of time. We're in the 20th century now, the very dawn of the 20th century. If we look at yet another sad case, and that would be William McKinley.
McKinley was the third president to be assassinated, and another case where the medical care was worse than the actual gunshots were. He had been at the Pan American Exposition, essentially the World's Fair of the day in Buffalo, New York in 1901, was shot by an anarchist and seemed to be rallying, but then the infection set in. About 6 days afterwards, he died. McKinley is one of those presidents who his reputation has fallen tremendously. And you see this often with the presidents of his era, the sort of late 19th century presidents, and this is the Victorian era where the bigger tomb is the better tomb and the more ornate tomb is the better tomb. McKinley's tomb in Canton, Ohio is built on the side of an enormous hill. There's like 100 and some steps that you walk up to get there, and it looks like a planetarium on the side of the hill. It's a very large, imposing kinds of structure, and he's a president who's almost completely forgotten today, or when he comes up, it's usually he doesn't get the benefit of the historical doubt, I guess is a nice way to put it. There are a number of McKinley statues across the country, but over time those memorials have largely been forgotten, and the most well-known memorial to McKinley is no longer a McKinley memorial at all. It was last year when President Obama announced that Mount McKinley, the highest mountain in North America, the one in Alaska, would no longer be called Mount McKinley, that it would be called Denali, as the Athabascans in Alaska preferred and had always referred to it. The story of Mount McKinley is a controversial one. The Canton delegation to Congress had done some procedural maneuvering to make sure that it was impossible for anyone to change the name. And it was just out of local pride. McKinley had never been to Alaska, had never spent any time there, and only had the mountain named after him because someone who supported his bid for the presidency happened to be traveling through the area at the time and wrote to a prominent newspaper to suggest the name.
So it was named for him while he was still alive.
It was named for him while he was still alive and hadn't even yet been president. But over the decades, people assumed that it had something to do with him being president,
sure,
maybe a memorial to an assassinated president, and so they largely left it alone until last year. Now, at the time that this decision came out, I was working at New Hampshire Public Radio, and we were in the midst of our presidential primary coverage. The governor of Ohio, of course, John Kasich, was running for president. He was in the studios the day this was announced, and so one of my colleagues asked him, "So what do you think about this name change?" And Kasich said, you know, if I'm elected president, we're changing the name back.
Changing it back. Does that name change apply to the park also or just the mountain?
The park had already been renamed. That was part of the compromise they had reached a couple of decades ago, that that the name of the mountain would stay McKinley, but the park would be known as Denali.
You could argue that McKinley is overshadowed largely because TR had a better PR. I mean, McKinley actually busted more trusts than Teddy Roosevelt did.
And Taft wound up doing more for conservation just in terms of a number of acres than Roosevelt did. But I mean, Taft is a great example of how your PR can have an effect on your presidential afterlife. We think of Teddy Roosevelt as the vigorous president. He was the athletic president, the outdoor president. Taft, we think of as the fat president, you know, which is, I mean, what a rotten thing to say, but, you know, to sum up a man's life and his career. He was the only man to be both president and chief justice of the United States. And we call him the fat one.
He was also a congressman, too, wasn't he? He was the only one to be in all three branches.
Secretary of War. He had just done a number of things, a very accomplished, distinguished and well-regarded man. But our public attitudes about weight have conspired against him. It's not known, and this is the PR issue. Taft didn't understand PR, didn't know how to do it, and certainly didn't photograph as well as Teddy Roosevelt did, who understood the power of the press. William Howard Taft actually lived longer than Teddy Roosevelt did, but we remember Taft as the unhealthy one because of how he looked in pictures and how Teddy Roosevelt came across as a vigorous, strenuous kind of person. So those public attitudes and the way that the media portrays people, especially at that period of time, did favors for Teddy Roosevelt, and by comparison, Taft just couldn't compare.
Well, speaking of image and timing, Brady, Warren G. Harding had great image, looked great, presidential.
They said he looked like a president. And what happened to Harding, he was another one who died early in his term. He died in August of 1923. And it started to come out about a scandal involving some of the people that worked for him, some of his cabinet members and other close associates of the Harding White House, the Teapot Dome scandal. And what happened was when he died, he was in the midst of trying to defend his administration against these allegations. And there was goodwill toward him after he died. And it didn't last forever. As they were raising money to try and build the Harding Memorial, which was a beautiful design, and it is a beautiful space in Marion, Ohio. It's this round sort of Roman structure with columns. It's an open air. It's a beautiful space.
Very unlike the man himself.
Very unlike. He was a very plain man otherwise. But they had a lot of trouble raising money for this. The more allegations would come out about Teapot Dome or about Warren Harding having mistresses in the White House, the harder they found it to raise money for his memorial. And they did eventually get it done. But even just pretty much right after it came out and was formally dedicated, it got few visitors. When I came, I only happened to see one other pair of people there, and it was not because they were paying their respects to the President of the United States. It was a big black limo, and out popped – this was in May – and out popped a pair of high school students who were on their way to prom. So their prom photographer thought this was the most scenic spot in Marion, Ohio.
How romantic.
And so they used the backdrop of the Harding Tomb as the background for their prom photos.
There is this 20th century phenomenon when it comes to presidential afterlives. And that's the Presidential Library. How did that get started?
That got started because of Franklin Roosevelt, who was as close to a hoarder as we've ever had in the White House. He just loved to collect things. He had a very famous stamp collection as president that was worth tens of thousands of dollars. And he collected model ships, and he just liked having things around. And of course, the most important collection he had was his collection of official documents dating back to his days as an assistant secretary of the Navy to governor of New York, and then, of course, elected to four terms as president of the United States. And Roosevelt had an eye toward history, as most presidents do, and he also had an understanding of how historians worked. He saw a win-win situation for both his reputation as a past president and for scholars. He said, what if we build a presidential library funded by the federal government that will house all of my papers and all of my stuff? Then people can learn about my place in history. You all can have access to my presidential papers, which, by the way, was very uncommon in those days. Presidents took their papers with them for the most part and either donated them or sold them to the government if they chose to. So we actually had access to Franklin Roosevelt's papers before either President Adams or the Lincoln papers or many of George Washington's papers. And so while it was considered by many at the time to be a little bit questionable whether we should have a sitting president using taxpayer dollars to build himself a monument. Some of the opponents in Congress said this is not ancient Egypt. We don't build pyramids in America. But Franklin Roosevelt got that through, and that has been the biggest change in the presidential afterlife since the beginning of the country, because that idea that of the George Washington days of a private citizen was completely gone. Now presidents aren't not only returning to private life, they are now being buried on land that is administered by the National Archives and Records Administration. And their documents and their personal effects are being kept in federally funded presidential libraries. So they are now being given the keys to their own afterlives and their own legacies in a way.
Don't they have kind of a slanted outlook, these libraries, though? Aren't they sort of pro-president, you know?
I talked with one scholar of presidential libraries, and the phrase he used to describe them was archives of spin. And that is the general contention is that at least when they first opened, because the presidents care very much about what their libraries are going to be like and are often very personally involved. So they tend to steer the narrative of the libraries in a way that is favorable to their own presidencies. What often happens is that over time, as the first generation of the presidential library sort of wraps up and they realize it's time to overhaul, a new generation of scholars comes in and they tend to build exhibits and document collections that are a little bit more even-handed. For example, the Franklin Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, New York now has a very large exhibit where you can look at Japanese internment, and they look at some of the decisions, right or wrong, that were made during World War II. They look at whether some of the New Deal projects actually worked or didn't work. And that's not always the case when a library first opens, but over time they tend to, not always, but tend to become more balanced.
I would guess that a key ingredient to that would be the actual death of the president whose library it is.
They keep a close watch on their libraries while they're still around. In fact, there's a story that people at the Lyndon Johnson Library in Texas used to tell about how he would constantly want to know how the attendance numbers were. And he would be sending these sometimes cockamamie ideas about, you know, what if we told the University of Texas to broadcast over their PA system during the football games that, you know, people could come in and use our bathrooms, and, or, you know, or maybe we could stand outside handing free donuts out in the morning to the college students at the university. So they really do want to have a successful library, and sometimes they're in competition with each other. They want to have a more successful library than any of the other presidents.
They never stop competing.
That's right.
Even in the afterlife, it would seem. Well, Betty Carlson, thanks for walking us through some of these presidential afterlives.
It has been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Betty Carlson is the author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders, published by Norton in 2016. And you can also hear him hosting All Things Considered here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll be tuning in next time for University of the Year.